at a certain point, you need to translate it into a bet, you know, translate it into something that, you know what, you might not have everyone's agreement with it the same way. You might not believe. You've spent some time surfacing the differences in perspective. You have to turn it into something tangible.
Yeah.
There's decreasing rewards of trying to spend more time to get people, because I made this recent talk called The Alignment Trap. And basically my point in this talk was, we spend way too much time to try to get alignment. Like, you're not going to align people after a certain point. In fact, it's good that people see different ways and different things.
Welcome to a new episode of Product Directions Podcast, 100 Product Strategies. We are your insider access to top product leaders shaping the strategy of the most diverse industries today. I'm your host, Nacho Vassino, and I'll be digging into the real-life situations, problems, and frameworks used for strategy with product people all around the world in all kinds of products and markets. While there is no recipe for success, listening to others' experiences may give you the edge you need to solve your next strategic challenge.
Hello everyone, welcome to a new episode. Today I'm with Sean Cotrer, a very thoughtful thought leader in product management that I have admired and followed for a long time. So really happy to have you here. Sean, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I like to say, like, I'm an afterthought leader, or like a second on second thought leader. Like, you scare me with the thought leader thing, but yeah, I'll take it for now. That's good.
Okay. So can you introduce yourself and a bit of your background and what you have been doing lately?
Sure. Yeah. So John Cutler, I have a background in product management, UX. And then, you know, before all this, maybe it was more business analyst roles. And then I had a life before this as a musician and doing other things. So that was a transition that I made. But really in the last, you know, 7-8 years, mostly B2B SaaS companies, either in, you know, a UX research role or a product role. And then recently, you know, for about 4 years, I worked for a company called Amplitude as a product evangelist, which is really interesting because my role got me in touch with a lot of companies from around the world, which is really, really exciting. I got to meet great people. I got to, you know, work with you. We did a lot of stuff. And then I was sort of, I have a soft spot for being, you know, in the weeds again, like in the mess directly. So I pivoted to working back full time at a company called Toast, and they do like, you know, food tech, not restaurant tech, that type of stuff. I have a mix of product operations and product enablement.
That's pretty cool. So in this episode, I want to start by exploring your concept of the messy middle, because I feel it relates very well to strategy. So jumping a bit directly into it, I would like to have a brief explanation of why, what it is and why it's important.
Yeah, we were chatting about this before. We could take messy middle in a couple of different ways. But the way I use that a lot is, you know, most people can relate to these very actionable things we do at work. You know, we go in, we do a task, you know, we do something. And even in organizations that are maybe very data driven, you know, we might impact a metric. We do something, something happens. You know, it feels very real. And then in a lot of discussions about strategy and other things, we can all sort of relate to that. The long-term ideas, you know, the company's growing, the company is thriving. You know, there's many things happening that in retrospect, often with strategy, we're like, well, we figured it out. You know, we got these things. But these are sort of long-term lagging outputs of doing the right thing. And so most of us can relate to that. You know, you go to the talk at the beginning of the year and the CEO or whoever say, here's the pillars of our strategy. You know, and they feel very like whatever, you know, and you've got your work to doing these things. And so the messy middle for me is really these, and it's something we explored a lot in the workshops I did at Amplitude with different frameworks and things, but really is somewhere between there, there's this place where the work and what you're doing is starting to impact things at longer time horizons, and you're not able to make the connections as immediately to what you're doing. And in my mind, also related to strategy, that's, you know, that's where a lot of the strategic thinking happens, right? Like understanding those impacts are where it's happening. So hopefully that gives you a description. I think, you know, one analogy you could use in your personal life is, you know, there's the things you do every day, or maybe even that week or the month. And then there's, you know, our long-term aspirations of like, oh, we're going to do this with our family, or we're going to do this with our money, or we're going to do these things. And then there's this kind of gray area between those two things. And that's where a lot of the debates happen in companies. The actionable things feel real, so everyone understands them. The long-term things feel exciting, and frankly, they're not very real feelings, so everyone can agree with them. It's the middle things that are really complicated for teams. So yeah, that's my interpretation of it.
Absolutely. That resonates a lot with the challenges I see product leaders kind of coming up with. As you said, the big bullet points of the strategy are easy to agree on or easy to define, but then getting that into actual work and connecting to what the teams are doing and contributing to is very hard. So maybe the natural question, since you did a bit of workshop on that, is what do you recommend to product leaders or even to product teams kind of trying to solve this messy middle problem?
Well, I think that, I mean, ultimately you have to name it to tame it. You know, you have to put a label on those things. And so I would say, you know, it's very popular these days. There's a number of these sort of mapping and graphing techniques. And what are all of them doing? All of them basically are creating input-output relationships or causal relationships. So very, very clearly, someone will make a map of something and say, we're working on this to impact this, to impact this, to impact this, to impact this. They're all kind of the same in a sense, because what they're talking about is they're talking about like a causal chain or a causal tree to do these things. Yeah. So I think that the reason why these different techniques, North Star framework and opportunity solution tree and impact mapping and blah, 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 all these things are the same, the reason why they're attractive to people is because they get those conversations going. Mm-hmm. You know, they explore it. And it's funny, when we did these workshops a lot, I could almost guess where it would be for teams. You know, I would say to them something like, okay, tell me what you're working on. And they would list all the things that they're working on. And then I would say, well, why are we doing that? Or what are we hoping to influence? And when teams were new, you know, they would go from that thing immediately to the long-term bullet point. You know, we're being customer centric this year, you know, and it's like, you could feel it. You could feel that there was a lot in between that. So you would say to the team, you know, like, look, I need you to give me some of the things in the middle. And they say, well, we're working on this to maybe do that, you know? And so that's where the discussions happen. So I think that the actionable thing most companies can do is, it doesn't really matter the method that you're using. I actually think now in retrospect, what matters is that people are talking about it and putting a name on those things. Another thing too, is that for every team is just to take one step, and I call kind of like bumping up or pushing up one level. So, you know, I use many funny tricks with teams. You know, I'll say, well, you know, oh, that's a 1 to 3 week bet. Well, what's your 1 to 3 month bet? You know, just like one level. And I'll say, well, I think it's, I'll say, well, what's your 1 to 3 quarter bet? Oh, great. What's your 1 to 3 year bet? Well, what's your 1 to 3 decade bet? You know, kind of going up the stack. For many teams, just going one level higher is really, really important. That, and you know, I created this sort of framework called mandate levels, but in mandate levels, you know, you sort of are describing what I just talked about. And for many teams, it was just going one level higher in the discussion that was like a big step for that particular team. And so I think that, I don't know if that helps, but I think, you know, labeling it, discussing it, and then, you know, having those discussions with your teams is just basically the start. It sounds easy, but it's way harder in practice to do.
I love the mandate levels framework as well. I actually use it with some teams when having this exact discussion. what I tend to feel is that, maybe going back to what you were saying, when a strategy goes wrong, you can basically justify anything you are doing to this kind of high level thing like customer centric. So what I find these maps useful for, I mean, even when you can go from what you are doing to the higher levels, is trying to understand the complexity of what we might call the opportunity space or the problem space, or and then going through a more logical selection of the topics and which one are more important. So maybe a question to that is, how do you feel when you are coming from bottom up, how can you explore this sort of, okay, let's think wider instead of narrower?
Well, here's the funny thing. When you create a safe space for teams, I've never found it difficult for them to explore the space of things. I mean, I know this sounds dumb, but like, I have very simple rules. You know, it's sort of like, look, if you just start on what you're doing, okay, what are you hoping to impact? This. okay, give me five other ways to do that. Great. Boom, 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 boom. Great. You know, it's actually kind of a game, you know, and so it's not like they haven't thought about those particular things or they didn't discuss those things. But often in the way that people work, they've settled on one idea, they've settled on one thing. And so that's just that basic discussion. You know, it's a little bit like you talk to someone and they say, well, where are you going on vacation? Switzerland. Why are you going on vacation? Well, I want to spend more time skiing. What are five other ways that you could go ski? Well, I could go to these other places, you know, but they've dreamed to go to Switzerland to do these things. You know, why do you want to go skiing? Well, we want to have, you know, there's different things you could do with it. So I think that it's the other thing too, is you build a sense for when you're up too high or too low. Like if you say, how should we be customer centric? And you start brainstorming, you'll have 1,000 sticky notes.
Yeah.
You know, you've probably started too high, right? Like to what you're doing. One other thing you realize as well is that people are very drawn to solutions. We all are, actually. And so one thing you learn is that solutions are the clue. People, I think, get afraid of talking about solutions. They say, well, we shouldn't talk about solutions yet. Well, I think very differently. Talk about solutions all day. Let's brainstorm 20 ways you could do it, because that's kind of data to learn about some ways that you could think about impacting these particular things. Another thing that I've thought a lot about is everyone says, my company doesn't have a strategy. We don't have a, if only we had a strategy, if we just had a strategy. Look, I think in the real world, it's like a lot harder to do that. I think what they're saying is, I wish someone could make decisions. I wish we could have I wish I could have clarity. Strategy is messy. So I sometimes think they don't really want a strategy. What they want is they want someone to make some decisions and have an opinion on what to do. So they're not trying to juggle as many different trade-offs that they want. So yeah, as kind of an aside to the question, but I think ultimately, you know, it is just this game of kind of going up and going down the tree and talking, having these discussions, and sometimes just giving teams permission to talk about that. They're very good at it. It's not like they need to a lot of prompting, which I think is why a lot of these techniques are very popular. You know, so take something like an opportunity solution tree or something like that. The reason why that framework is so effective is because when you give people permission to just talk about it and visualize it, they'll do it. Whereas actually in discussions about, I have much harder times getting senior leaders to actually go deep on strategy than I do having teams to think about going up and down the opportunity space or something like that. And because I think that one of those discussions is pretty threatening and you have to, it's hard. It's a lot of mental work. You got to do these things. The opportunity stuff in those spaces, teams, once you say go for it, they go for it. Like they go and figure it out.
But one thing that's interesting about what you said, and relating back to what I was saying, I hope we have more strategy, which totally relates to making decisions. Actually, the going away from the victim position, when you visualize things, when you visualize options, and you can actually go back to your management and say, hey, this is what we are seeing, which path we can take, or we believe this is the right path. Do you agree? So you enable, as you said, you enable the conversation, which is the richest part of this
maps. And I mean, if you look at any strategy framework, you look at, so look at like Rumelt or something like that. You know, they have these four categories, and the last one is coherent actions. It's basically like, you know, kernel diagnosis, guiding principles, and the last one is coherent action, I think. The reason why those end up at coherent action is because that actually feels real to people. Most people, I remember a CEO once telling me after we did a session on strategy, they said, this is great, but I can't tell the company this. Why? Well, we have an existential crisis. Yes, you do. He's like, I can't just go to the company and say, hey, everyone, we've got an existential crisis, because they all say we want a strategy. But if you actually say this, right? I was telling you before, I was involved in sports and things, and it's like, you know, you'd arrive at a race, we were racing bikes and something. And, you know, sometimes the strategy was like, we are not as strong and we're all tired and we're going to get beaten. And there's a 10% chance that we can win this race if we just do this thing. That's hard in a corporate setting. You know, like imagine the CEO at kickoff in the beginning of the year is like, there is a 20% chance we can succeed here. Thank you very much. This is my speech. So my point back to that thing is that for most of the company, even when people say we want a strategy, most people in the company equate a strategy to clear ideas of coherent actions that they can take. Yeah. And so I think that that's a realistic, that's real world, versus like the strategy nerd community. You want to think about it all day. You love saying, well, that company, they're going to die soon. You know, like it's easy to talk like that from the outside, but when you're inside, you're not going to talk like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have so many questions about what you said, but maybe we'll start with a big one, because you talk a lot about bets, right? And the way you're describing this, feels like at the end of the day, when you are doing strategy or the CEO of management is doing strategy, at the end of the day, they are kind of making a decision to bet in this particular branch of the tree or in this particular side of the impact map or whatever. But actually, that's the sort of thing that we're going after.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing I like the framing of bet, because, you know, it has risk, it has reward, it has, you know, upside, downside. You know, to make bets, you need information, which is great. Like, to make a good bet, you need information to make a bet, but you can't wait forever for perfect information. You know, it's like, it's a fun analogy to do that. The way that I think about it is that there are bets, again, at different levels. Like, core strategic bets might be like where we're going to play, you know, like that kind of thing. And so those decisions feel very distant. You know, they're going to impact lots of these related bets, but it's a very like abstract bet. And that might be like, that might be a 1 to 3 decade bet or 1 to 3 year bet. You know, we're going to generally play in this particular area to do it. How that gets translated into the much more like tactical, I hate the word tactical because it makes it seem like strategic is, I just generally think of strategic as more, it's more future forward. It has a lot more interweaving parts built into the particular thing. And it doesn't feel as action-like. It's much more we're betting on the world. You know, we're betting on where competitors are going to go. We're betting on our capabilities that we might need. We're betting on these things. It feels more like you're betting on where the whole weather is going. You know, like that feels like strategic to me. The tactical thing does feel like, and today we're going to bring our raincoat, or, you know, today we're going to prepare for a flood or something like that. So I don't say tactical as a bad thing. But generally, you know, those larger strategic bets do translate into things that feel more actionable.
Yeah.
They feel more approachable and impactable, if that makes sense.
But I mean, one of the things I love about your framework of the messy middle is that at the end of the day, and even the money levels, it's a set of nested bets. So it's very arbitrary to say which is strategic and which is tactical, because at the end of the day, one is responding to the other. So it's
And that's a big,
as long as they are interconnected, right? That's the tricky part.
Well, and I think that that's the thing of, and that's the hard part about talking about those middle types of bets too, you know, because they are emergent, and they might not feel as actionable for some people as they would like, and they might not feel as big and things as other things as you like. So, you know, and that's the thing about strategy. You know, I have a strategy for how I'm going to operate my day today. I said, I'm going to wake up early and get the kid to school, you know, like I'd get to school and I had a general strategy for how my day is going to go. And I'm going to have a strategy. I'm going to spend the next 10 years of my life. So it's almost like, that strategy is a very fractal set of things. So that's like
that's a good point. I mean, to go back from the nerdy world to more actionable, when you are, for example, interacting with product leads and you are recommending how strategy should look like, what are some of the tips you give them, or some of the guidelines?
Yeah. So there's a couple things that I've been thinking a lot lately. So one is that strategy is about picking the right questions to answer and your current answer to those questions.
Okay.
So I'll say to a team on a very simple level, like, look, there's lots of questions we have right now. Which are the important ones that we should have a perspective on? This. Maybe it's where we're going to play. It might, for that team, it might not be what market are we in? That's not actionable to them at the moment. But for that particular team, let's say that someone's thinking about a customer journey problem, and, you know, and maybe there's this key question of like, if the company goes to a certain market, you're going to not have that kind of motion in your company. So one person is going to say, well, I think we need to have an answer to this question about where we're going. Okay. Yeah. And there's a lot of things that don't matter. You know, I say to them, what questions don't matter right now? It doesn't matter this. It doesn't matter this. It doesn't matter all these things. Okay. So you've got a list of questions. And then it's basically like, do we have an answer for that right now? And then I use this idea of like operating assumptions, because sometimes basically it's like, we don't have a 100% confident answer, but let's operate under the assumption that XYZ is going to be true. And then let's do it. So if you, and this is kind of a funny way to think about strategy, because everyone has these canvases and everyone has all these things. All these things are basically trying to remind you what questions to ask yourself. And then ultimately you have an answer for it. And either your answer is something that you have with conviction, or you have with, it's either an insight or a belief. You know, it might be like a strong belief that you have. It might be an assumption. It might be I called it FAB, facts, assumptions, beliefs. It's either a fact or it's an assumption, or it's a deeply held belief that you have about that particular question. And then you either need a strategy to get more information about it, or you're going to operate based on the assumption that something is true until you get more information about it. So this sounds, but this is very actionable with a team. It's basically like, it sounds so dumb, but many teams miss this out. It's just like, what questions do we need to answer? And what's our current answer? Do we even need to care? Is it a fact? Is it an assumption? Is it a belief? And do we need to collect more information to feel more confident about it? And let's go. And that is a strategy in a sense. And like a lot of people, when you make it like that, it feels way less intimidating. When you go and you say it's a strategy, for many people, they think like they Google things and they see McKinsey and see this and Horizons and all this kind of stuff. And sometimes it just gets in the way of trying to answer those questions.
Maybe one interesting point of what the whole thing we were saying is that, so I will go a bit into the stakeholder alignment or however you call it. But I have found that this topic of making explicit the degree of confidence or as a kind of fact versus because at the end of the day, facts also has some shades of gray. So how do you feel about those conflicts of, hey, maybe my belief is different from the stakeholder belief or things like that? So aligning on these bets when you don't have facts, how do you recommend teams go?
I think what I'm learning, so this is this is my thing with Lean Startup and Eric Ries. Like, I remember startups being like, oh my God, that feels like so intellectually rigorous. Like, we're going to have a hypothesis and then we're going to prove or disprove the hypothesis. Now, if you talk to any startup founder, after 1 month of trying that, no one went back to the canvas to say that thing. They were like, this is hard. I need to survive. My God, you know, I believe in my product. Like, screw these experiments. We don't need anything to do it. So I think that realistically, I'm saying that. I'm sure people did it effectively, but at least in my experience of talking to founders and other people, it all made sense intellectually. But then when people tried to do it, it all kind of falls apart. Yeah. So related to this is, I think you shouldn't spend too much time believing that if you surface everyone's assumptions and everyone's things that you're going to find reality and everyone's going to agree. So I think that ultimately with these exercises, it's about a period. You have to time box it. And you have to, and this is where coherent action fits in. Like, at a certain point, you got to time box it. And you know what? The person in sales might think that enterprise is going to be an amazing business. And then the other person in marketing doesn't even know what enterprise means. And the teams are like, yeah, but the architecture is never going to survive those things. And you're never going to get them all to agree, because they all kind of see their version of reality to do it. At a certain point, you can, and this is where, you know, company culture and commitment and committing to this idea of doing these things is, at a certain point, you need to translate it into a bet, you know, translate it into something that, you know what, you might not have everyone's agreement with it the same way. You might not believe you've spent some time surfacing the differences in perspective. You have to turn it into something tangible.
Yeah.
At a certain point. And I would say that to anyone listening, you know, there's decreasing rewards of trying to spend more time to get people, because I made this recent talk called The Alignment Trap. And basically my point in this talk was, we spend way too much time to try to get alignment. Like, you're not going to align people after a certain point. In fact, it's good that people see different ways and different things. Mm-hmm. And so I basically said, like, at a certain point, you just got to create the conditions where different perspectives are going to just generally push you in the right direction.
Yeah.
And then just and surf that wave to do that. So I don't know if that's, don't try to be too intellectual about it, but basically, I don't think people, after a certain point, any extra efforts to try to tease out more assumptions, more beliefs, more data, more of those things going to hit the wall you talked about. Yeah. And that point, when you start to propose different solutions, you know, you go into whatever tree or map or whatever, when you start to just see where there's convergence on those ideas, you have to translate it to action, because people agree to actions. They don't agree to workshops where they talk about assumptions. You know, they're not like, oh, you caught me right there. I remember a year ago we did the workshop. You're right. I'm going to go back and update my thing. It doesn't work like
that. No, what's interesting that, I mean, I really resonate with the idea of the time box you said, because what I usually said is, going back to what I was saying, kind of, these are bets.
Yeah.
What you don't need to say, hey, this bet is $1 million and we need to put all the money right now. We can spend $10,000 to kind of build something, test something, gather more information, and then commit the extra bucket and kind of keep growing from there. Because also one thing that teams or leaders, product leaders used to kind of fear is that once I place a bet, I need to stay with my strategy for a year. No, that's not true. I mean, the intention is that you start going in some direction and you collect feedback from it.
And isn't this what agility is about into these things? And this is why the people who are like, strategy doesn't matter, you know, it's just execution to this thing. There's something to be said for, and this is, you know, I don't think, you know, maybe, I don't know, you know, depending on the strategy thing you think about, like, people will talk about your ability to execute and your operational ability as an input into your strategy. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people, when I see them on LinkedIn say, if we just had a strategy, if we do this, I think to myself, like, uh-oh, that company has gotten to a point where it doesn't have options. And so strategy is also about creatively deciding which options not to pursue and where to create optionality in your actions, right? Of things that you're doing. Like, you think about how to create optionality. So if you're kind of ahead of the strategy loop versus your competitors, you have the ability to make more mistakes. Like, you have the ability to learn things faster. You have more options that you can potentially take that you're not necessarily investing in at that point. If a company has gotten to that point where it's decided to try to be a million things to a million different people, strategy is very, very difficult, because every strategic choice is going to have very large impact and ramifications for the particular business that it has. So it's kind of, you know, the analogy, again, I'll just use this bike racing thing because that's something I was doing. You know, when you arrive with a strong team and you have lots of options and you have a lot of people on your team who can win, you can take more risks. Uh-huh. And if you arrive with no one on your team or three people, there's only one way you can win, and it's going to be very difficult to be able to do it. So I think that that's something people forget, that they imagine as strategy as being much more decisive. But when you see companies that are doing it well, they have a lot more options. And so it's more of a, it's more that type of discussion than, like, you know, we need the strategy to save us type thing.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is, because also on the other hand, so you need to have this, as you said before, I mean, someone needs to make a decision. We're going to bet on this space. So if, let's say, you want to expand internationally, that's something that probably is coming from the CEO, and then there is an appetite for making an investment in taking that risk. And then what the optionality comes into, okay, we're going to test many ways to penetrate in this market. So there is some level of, hey, we are definitely going this direction, and we will, maybe from this time box, we're saying we will test many time boxes to see what's the right way, but the strategic direction is clear. And until we test it many ways and we kind of fail, we will keep pushing for this strategic direction.
There's a lot of last responsible decision. I mean, a company like that, like, if a company has a lot of tailwinds and is doing pretty well, they have so many more options at their disposal to think about things. They can enter, they can fail a couple times. They can, you know, they can have 15 products that never get off the ground, and they can think that they're doing these things. Whereas, I mean, this is the one thing too, I think for most startups, strategy is a very simple thing, because all you need to do is survive. There's only one thing. You're vastly outnumbered. You're vastly out things. You have one shot at doing these things. I think where it gets interesting, this is where there's a transition as companies scale to a point where things get harder and things get more complex. And you have to start thinking more strategically to do the thing. Yeah. You know, so this is what's very fascinating to me about the strategy and this messy middle stuff, because it is very like, I think people have in their mind what it feels like to have this like great strategy. And realistically, in most companies, it's like this survival situation. It's like really just one strategy.
I feel like also we have these views in retrospective that this company had a great strategy, so they succeeded. And in actually, when they weren't running with it, it was probably much more chaotic than we believe. For example, we touched base about Amazon briefly before. They have a lot of successes and failures, but also they have this commitment coming from professors or very high level people. For example, with Prime lost money for a lot of, and we can probably have many examples from Amazon with this same logic in, hey, we need to keep pushing for this, and eventually, you know, Fire Tablet, maybe killed Prime, super success. So this is kind of the best.
Yeah, I think, and I think that for a lot of people in their company too, you also have to realize this is going to sound so bad. But basically, there is a theory that 99% of companies are slowly dying. I've learned, and I learned this at Amplitude meeting with so many different companies, that the macro factors determining the whole cycle of a company are off. Most people are not thinking about that, even like VPs or whatever. But if you step back and if you think of the company, you're like, okay, that company, they're riding this wave. It has a couple surprises left in that wave. It's going to be attractive to investors. You know, some companies will get bought. Some companies will just die. Some companies will get, you know, they'll have these exits and they'll do these different things. You start to see it as you step back. You're like, wow, there's everyone who looks at these matrix diagrams of all the companies in a certain space, all of them are like little ants, like pursuing some anthill together. Like, so that's this kind of like ecosystem view of strategy. You tend to think of it as like, and when we're in one company, even very skilled people are not realizing that the macro factors determining that space might just be the macroeconomic factors combined with how investors, like many people are at a startup and they think, oh my goodness, we don't have a strategy. It's terrible. But they're not in the room at the time that the investor gave the company $100 million based on the investor's bet that either I want to be a $7 billion company, or I just want out quickly. They weren't in that conversation. And so they're sitting there in, you know, thinking my company doesn't have a strategy. We don't know what we're doing. Like we're idiots. And like, why are we doing it? But if you step back, the company is just one strategic bet for an investor out of 1,000 different companies in their portfolio. So it's just a funny way to think of it.
One thing I thought that this trigger is that, what's the value attribution of having a good strategy? Because theory will claim is that besides everything we discussed before, what you will say is that you are trying to select something that gives you an advantage to compete in that kind of ecosystem that you were mentioning. So you are trying to find, okay, this ant hill that we are climbing, which is the way I can climb faster or the strength I can leverage to go faster than my competitors. I'm not sure where I'm going with this question, but what I'm trying to say is that
the attribution,
even though you're having this fatalistic view, I think at the end of the day, there is some reasoning for people climbing for a strategy and leaders actually putting some thought into it.
Remember, I'm just talking about scales. Like, it obviously does matter for the company. I mean, if you're a betting person, you know, that's the thing is you show up at a race or you show up at a thing and you're going to have people who don't have a good strategy and people have a marginally better strategy. I would expect generally better results from the people who had a better strategy to do these things. And I think that one thing, the idea I've been using a lot lately is, you know, it is really about deciding where to, the companies can waste so much money cumulatively on stuff. Legitimately, even if you look back in 6 to 12 months, you'll be like, what were we thinking? Like that lack of, you know, so I think that sometimes the ROI on this thing is just, you're just, I got really into this idea of capital efficiency in the last like 6 months and thinking about how are we using our capital efficiently, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's different from normal efficiency, which might be like, you know, if you think of a garden, you know, you think there's productivity, efficacy, efficiency, scalability, those things. And so efficiency has an idea of like, you know, you basically, you're growing for the lowest amount of input money that you're putting into this particular thing. One thing that you learn when you think about capital efficiency is that the phrase capital efficiency is important because it's always pinned to your strategic objectives. So mm-hmm. if someone like cuts 10% of their teams because someone has said, you just have to, you need to hit this profitability goal, that's not capital efficiency. Because capital efficiency, by definition, is a more long-term thing. What's mm-hmm. your capital in your company? It's the knowledge you have. It's the smarts. It's the IP that you have. There's all sorts of different forms of capital within the company to do it. Yeah. So you're thinking about your long-term strategic objective. So that's how I tend to think about strategy and its impact on capital efficiency. And so when you have a good strategy, you tend to make better decisions about applying your capital efficiently. So if you send half of your team to do some dead end thing that no one really thought through, and 3 years later, you're struggling because you have to, do reactive things to stay relevant in the market. The cost of that decision is not just the salaries of the people that you decided to make do the thing. It's also the extra impact on capital efficiency 3 years from then when you had your back against the wall. So when you see companies that have to do like M&A strategy because they were never able to do the right thing internally, what you're talking about is you're almost talking about the byproduct of those strategic decisions. Like, is there a way that maybe they could have fostered those products internally? Now, M&A is an interesting thing because M&A can be a viable strategy. You know, it can be like, mm-hmm. we'll never win this market unless we do that. So that's a great example of the ROI of this, like a reactive M&A strategy, because we move so slow, we couldn't figure this out ourselves, is very different from a deliberate, disciplined M&A strategy. And then back to your point about quantifying the impact of strategy is like that reactive form of strategy. What did that cost the company? How many options did it reduce to do it that way? So that's how I tend to think about it, is just as it relates to capital efficiency in terms of like long-term effects to do it.
Yeah. And then what's interesting about it is that at the end of the day, you are placing a bet. So, we can talk about the good results or the bonuses, for example. Talking about M&A, you can say, for example, you know, Google wanted to enter and conquer the video market. So they first started Google Video. They suck at it, but they stick to the strategy. So then they acquire YouTube and was a huge success. So that strategy, we can say the strategy was sound, but then the different investments have different level of returns depending on the second level action that you're taking on it.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to the nested nature of our work, in which we can never say the investors put 100 million was one bet of the multiple bets they have, but then internally in the company, different teams are, let's say, competing, not in the sums, but they are trying to say, hey, we need to bet on this team strategy, and we need 2 million to bet in that bet. So we have kind of a cumulative set of investments in different bets.
Yeah. And I think that's also goes to just bringing it to be very practical for people to think about it. It's, you know, this part of this is around when you're selling your ideas that you have and pitching your team and what you think you can do. It's framing that potential upside that you have with the teams. I'm always amazed how even teams like, you know, platform teams or even internally focused teams, you know, they'll say something like, oh, I think that we can get 3% productivity. And I'll ask them like, well, no. Like, what is that going to get us? And then I said, well, like, give me people. Like, what is it going to do? And this is, I'll say, point like that group over there. If you fix this thing, what is it going to let them do? Oh, they're going to go twice as fast. Oh, what's the value of the thing that they're doing? Well, they're building this and this. So like you're doubling the value creation capability of that and how fast they're going to learn if it's working or not. So don't talk to me about like 3% of, you know, like, do you know what I mean? Like people are really bad at pitching this stuff. So I'm like, you walk into a meeting and you say, I'm going to make 500 people 3% better. You know, that's like a couple meetings here and there. Like, it doesn't feel like a thing. But if you rather say, I'm going to make 50 people twice as fast and accelerate their strategy and accelerate what they're doing and doing that, that's my strategy, is to accelerate their strategy. That means a lot different. So one thing you remind, just while we were talking about it, is that I think this goes to how people position their teams and position their own bets and position these things. It's like, I think it's just a skill that you learn over time to think about the downstream and second order and third order impacts of what you're doing versus just the most tangible thing that's in front of you.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the pitfalls of product leaders or even product managers, and leads to all this Brian Chesky thingy, but all the blame about the value of product management is because product people is not pitching the value that they are contributing with the teams.
Yeah, I think, and I think also related to that, they also, people just fall into habits in their company, you know, like a lot of, I used to ask that a lot. You know, I always would love when an engineer, someone would say, what value are you bringing to us? You know, you sit in all these meetings, apparently dictating our future. And then you talk to some other people and then you come back to us and say, this is the thing. Like, what, like, when did you just last talk to customers? Like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing other than sitting in all these meetings, hearing all these different things and deciding on that? And I think that that goes a lot with, you know, if a product manager, I used to always say this a lot, like if a product manager says, wow, I read one somewhere that an engineer makes a cost benefit decision every 15 minutes. So I'm pretty sure that it's the same thing for a designer. And just thinking about the impact of strategy and the impact of context and insights and things like that, like the way that I would think about a PM was, wow, if I can just even add 10% or 20% to the decision quality of every single bet, like in one day, we're making 50 little mini bets and every day we're all making these bets. Yeah. And if I just can continue to add more context to do those things, I can bend the curve for our product to do that. Whereas like some PMs are just thinking, oh, could I get more story points out of the team or something? Like, it's just a very, very different way to think about what you're doing.
Yeah, I actually made it just a side thought, and I'm probably getting nowhere, but it's also about reducing the cognitive load of these many decisions, because now the engineer knows that probably we are going this direction, so you need to think about all these other ramifications because you know where you're going. But
isn't that strategy in a sense? So the analogy that I use for a lot of folks with about strategy now, and I talked about this in this alignment trap thing too, is a lot of people say, well, we want a simple strategy. Well, it's one thing. I think that that's right. But it's one thing to take a complex situation and then pretend it doesn't exist and say, well, we just got our five pillars for the company. But really, in a sense, strategy is deciding what parts of a complex problem you're going to hold constant.
Yeah.
It's like, we're not going to worry about that. It does narrow the focus of people to reduce cognitive load, to allow that. And we did an exercise internally with the teams, and I described sort of strategy, or at least these things, as automated no's and automated yeses. Like, you know, you've got, like, it just, to that point of having to make that many decisions all the time, it's like we've narrowed the world of what we need to do. And again, I'll keep this one analogy because I've been thinking about bike racing a lot because I'm out of shape and I want to get back into bike racing. But, you know, like when you start a race, it's like you would tell someone, if that person over there decides to ride away, you will be with them. That's it. You just need to sit behind them the whole race. And if they decide to ride away, just be behind them. Never go in front of them. Don't work with them. Just stay there. And they're going to hate you and they're going to shout at you and just stay there. Now, what is that doing? It's like that strategy, and it could change immediately. And obviously you trust people to change the things immediately if the things change, but that's like an automated yes, an automated no. Like, it's a very easy idea about what you need to do to do with that thing. And so anyway, it's like automated yeses, automated no's is an interesting idea.
Yeah, love it. Since we are running out of time, I want to go to my last closing questions. The first one is around other pitfalls that we may not have covered here and you may have seen teams falling into. When thinking about the strategy, of course.
When thinking about the strategy stuff. I think the difference between strategy deployment and strategy is often so mistaken that it's a huge problem. So basically, strategy deployment is about branding and about enablement and about making it understandable to everyone in the company. A strategy does not need to be understandable to everyone in the company. Mm-hmm. And people make this mistake all the time. Like, you don't need to, and this is the case too with what, like what I was saying about like that thing in the bike race, you know, about riding away to these particular things that, and what we said earlier, that most people don't want to know the actual strategy. Like they kind of do, but they don't want to know all the gory details of those things. So what you see people do is they're like, oh, I can't fit that on one slide right now. Like we have, you know, we're having this deep discussion about where the industry is going and the market's going, but oh, that's going to be too scary to put on the slide. So we have to stop talking about it. And I think the biggest problem is no, do not stop talking about it. Keep talking about it for like 3 days and then leave it to some other people to think about how to package that up. So you know, what they'll do is they, you know, people often look for a model that will help brand the strategy. They'll say, everyone, look, here's a triangle. And on one side, it's this, and one side, it's this, and one side, it's this. And we're going to play in the middle. And, or, you know, hey, here's a 2x2, and the competition is here, and we're going to be in the upper right. Or they think here's these pillars, or they think that, like, that is strategy deployment. It is not strategy. That is a communication technique to do the thing. Like, and so I think that that's the number one mistake I see, is people confusing those two things. A strategy should be simple and understandable and learnable, but that's a different problem.
Yeah.
And what is the strategy?
One thing that calls my attention, because you mentioned this also before when you're talking about the existential crisis, is that, so my initial thought or reaction is it's better when people understand why they are doing the things they're doing. And there's certain power in having these very strong problems, but the you know, the sense of urgency that can scare people, but can also motivate people to act faster. Yeah. So it's a kind of hard balance.
Well, and that's what I mean too about, you know, there's a great book, you know, called The Art of Action, which I think everyone should read. It's very good about, and it is very military based. So if you don't like military stuff, I'm not a big fan of military stuff, but I could read through it and do these things. But the analogy I used is this, is like, at the end of the day, you have to convert these things into very, you know, so they use an analogy of like, you know, you have a military and you're just like, you know, don't let the military cross this river if you do this. And if they do, kind of push them to the north. And if you've got these other things, do it. So it's something, and it's very concise. You know, it's like, we're going to do this. It's about communicating these guiding principles very, very effectively to do these things. Yeah. One analogy that I would use, though, is like, look, if you've got a military of 10,000 people on the river, you can say things like that because you've got 10,000 people. Now, if it's just 3 people, you're not going to say to them, hey, everyone, if the military crosses the river, just make sure they don't do it. No, you're going to probably say to them, like, I need you to stay at the top of that hill. Do not move. You know, like, hide and do this thing. Like, you're going to be much more specific about what you need. So I think that the point is, here's another thing too. I've seen very experienced people who don't even want to think about any of the messiness. They thrive on they are very tactically. That's why you want them in the company, because they're going to put all that. They'll say, I'm going to put that bullshit away because we don't have to worry about it. You're going to have other people in the company at the lowest level of your company I've seen this too, who will read the 15-page document and they're curious about it. Another thing is people make assumptions about people's strategic ability. And I always joke, you know, there's an engineer on the team. People are like, well, I don't think the engineers would be working about it. And what does this guy do? It turned out that he was like ranked in the top world for one of the most like hardest strategic online games that there was. Like, this person is not stupid, you know. And like, give me the document. I want to see the document to do this thing. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, this gets to your question. Everyone has different whys, and that's what makes the problem hard. These things about obsessing about the one slide is a never-ending failure mode, because realistically, you need 5 versions of that slide. Yeah. You know, like you need, it's not about having the one slide that everyone will understand. That is always going to be a sacrifice. I would also say that if you're strategically minded, never look at anything that the company gives you to communicate to everyone, because you will always be bored and you'll always be frustrated by it. So anything that gets presented to the whole company has already been modified down to the least common denominator. You will not be happy. In fact, don't go to that meeting. Don't look at that deck. Don't look at those things because you're going to get pissed off.
Yeah.
And so just go and like find some other thing to do and then ask them for the real strategy.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, one of the things I really kind of encouraged organizations to do is to kind of cascade the strategy, let's call it the real strategy, through the product, so through the leaders. Because at the end of the day, as you said, if you want having on all hands, it would be watered down necessary.
Yeah.
But for example, going back to the different motivations, as a product leader, you can understand the strategy, you will communicate to PMs, and you have one PM who is super motivated about, hey, we will make this $1 million, we have this market share, and I was, hey, we will solve this customer problem, which is a super painful problem for them.
This
and
is having that sensibility awareness. I wish I had it to share with folks because I've drawn this picture. I'll leave you the one thing, the last thing here that I've been getting deep into, which is I made a list with the team of all the different, what I call frames of strategy. There is an ecosystem frame. There's a technology ecosystem frame. There's a customer motion frame. There's a financial frame. There's the sort of venture frame, you know, about investment frame. There is a competitive frame. There's a this frame. There's a that frame. We made a list of 20 frames.
I really want to see that. So
yeah, it's like, and I call it like 20 frames of strategy. And what I realized when I was looking at that was I was like, this is the problem right here. All these are very valid frames. All these are very, it is a very valid to think about the customer's area and space and business and what's happening to it. That's like one frame. It's very smart to think about it just in the macro economic frame or whatever. And what I realized a lot of these problems with teams is that they're not even labeling these frames. You know, they're not like, they just, that's why these strategies start to feel so watered down because it's okay. And it's why it's hard for people to describe strategy in general because I always ask them what frame. Like what frame are we talking about? So it's kind of the role of leaders to either communicate the different frames or, you know, I use my friend's example from Netflix all the time now, which is like, you know, be HBO before HBO can be Netflix. Okay. And that was like a phrase that got said over and over. This was before Netflix became HBO, but then tried to be all of television. You know, so then Netflix was like, be TV before TV can be TV, right?
Yeah.
I always love that because your choices as a leader are either cater to the different frames, or that to me is when you talk about like finding the crux of the strategy or finding its graceful simplicity. It's not just dumbing it down. It's finding that one phrase in your company or set of phrases that the really smart person can run with 1,000 miles an hour, and also the person who's earlier in their career can get them thinking too. So graceful simplicity when you describe strategy is very different than dumbing it down. So your choices are either give all the different people their views into the strategy, a more complex document, many layers. And then the simplification is it's really true. You can, for that one slide, if you work hard enough, you can find an elaboration of your strategy that's simple, but powerful. Simple and powerful is much more important than simple and weak and fragile. So simple and powerful is what you're looking for.
And that's the point. I mean, we tend to jump to the simple before doing the hard work needed to get to the simplification. Yeah. So that's the gap.
Cool.
Okay, we're super out of time. So this has been wonderful. Where can people find you and what can they do for you?
Oh, geez. I'm so overwhelmed with the social media stuff now. I mean, just LinkedIn is probably the only, is where I'm going to camp out for a little while until I figure out my next move. And then like, that's where I am. So yeah, find me there.
Perfect. 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 So this has been wonderful. Thanks so much for sharing all this expertise. And I hope you enjoyed as well.
Yep. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Nacho.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of 100 Product Strategies, the podcast by Product Direction. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram to get access to free weekly content that helps product people upgrade their skills and become more successful. You can access more material, promotional trainings, and be notified of every episode of the show with Product Direction's weekly newsletter. Join thousands of product leaders by registering in productdirection.co.